Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On the wall of the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston hangs a portrait of Esther Wheelwright, an unassuming nun in a wimple surrounded by some of the most prominent men in early American history. Why? Well, Wheelwright was born in 1696. She was raised in a New England garrison town until she was captured by Wabanaki Indians at just 7 years old. By the time she was 13, she was living in a convent in French Canadian territory, and she eventually managed to rise to a position of power as Mother Superior of a monastery in Quebec. Colorado State University historian Ann Little tells her story in the new book, The Many Captivities of Esther Wheelwright. And Ann Little joins us now from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I mean, first of all, let's start with Wheelwright's earliest years as a young girl living in a colonial town, which was, I mean, then Wells, Maine, but it was still Massachusetts colony at the time. What would life have been like for her as a young girl?
Well, as I write in my book, she was very bounded from her very skin to the walls of the home that she lived in to the garrison walls that surrounded the village that she lived in. So in a variety of different ways, she had to operate within some very constraining boundaries.
And tell us more about why some of those boundaries existed. I mean, the garrison walls to begin with.
Well, the garrison walls were there in order to protect the little Anglo-American village from hostile Native American and French raiders, because Esther was born in 1696, and at the time she was captured in an attack on her village during Queen Anne's War. So the northeastern borderlands were pretty much from King Philip's War, beginning in 1675, until about 90 years later. There was one war after another. It was almost continuous warfare between the Anglo-Americans, French-Canadians, and Wabanaki and other Algonquian-speaking Indians.
And that obviously played a major role later in Esther's life. But bound also by her very skin?
Well, she, like other little girls and little boys, from infancy would have been put into stays, which were little miniature corsets that were put on infants and young children. At the age of 7, when boys were breeched, that is, they took off the gowns that they like little girls wore through their childhood, they would have been able to take off their stays. But little girls, of course, would have been constrained by stays for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And they new stays would have been given to them as they grew and as they matured. But those stays bound her body from infancy, well, until she began living with a Wabanaki family. I'm sure they took off the stays. But they would have bound her body through her life as an Anglo-American girl and woman.
Huh. So then tell us, how did Esther Wheelwright come to live with the Wabanaki and, first of all, to be captured by them?
Well, on August 10th, 1703, Wabanaki raiders attacked her village. We only have a couple of reports after the fact asking for supplies and for assistance from the government of Massachusetts. We don't even know exactly how she was taken. She's the only member of her nuclear family who was taken in this raid. A couple of her little girl cousins, however, survived the attack, and they were also taken with her. So I believe that she may have been sent by her mother as a 7-year-old girl over to essentially babysit her young cousins, who were, I believe, 2 and 4 when they were captured as well.
I see. Okay, so this is really fascinating, because we're in this second captivity, so to speak, to echo the title of your book, of Esther Wheelwright. I mean, what do we know about the years that she spent with the Wabanaki?
This is the most challenging chapter of the book for me to write, because there are almost no traditional historical sources I can use. In fact, there are no traditional historical sources that refer to her directly from this time period, from the age of 7 until about 12, until she's at the verge of adolescence. So I had to study other captivity narratives written by young New England people when they returned from captivity among the Wabanaki. I also read hundreds and hundreds of pages of the Jesuit relations in which they talk about the presence of young Anglo-American captives in the communities that they're that they're ministering to.
Hmm. I mean, so what were you able to piece together? I mean, because in a way, this, because we know so little, this is the most compelling, one of the most compelling parts of her story.
Well, thank you. I can't know, of course, for sure. But what we know from other captivity narratives and the other stories embedded in the Jesuit relations is that children like Esther were actually quite fortunate. Little girls were almost never subjected to any even kind of ritual torture, let alone any harsher methods. She almost undoubtedly would have been adopted into her family and would have been treated like a Wabanaki daughter. So I also think it was a great advantage to her to be only 7 years old at the time she crossed that boundary and to live among the Wabanaki, because, of course, her brain would have been quite plastic at that time period, and she probably would have been able to learn some Wabanaki and then perhaps with contact with a few French priests, maybe some French as well.
Oh, interesting. Now, I'm jumping ahead here a little bit, but you do write in your book that later on, both Esther Wheelwright and the Ursulines, the religious order that she ended up joining, they had their reasons for wanting to rewrite the story of her life, to play down her Wabanaki identity. What did you mean by that? The very fact that she could have even continued to have a Wabanaki identity. I'm curious.
Well, when I started writing this book, I think I kind of wanted to write a little bit of a different story about the history of race in North America. I wanted to write a book in which this little girl from this very segregated traditional Anglo-American community was able to sort of carry some of her Wabanaki identity into her French-Canadian life, mm-hmm. because we have a little bit of evidence and suggestions that people in New France were slightly less segregationist than the English colonists were. But in the end, I found that the women in the Ursuline order were just like their French Canadian families and neighbors, and they were very status conscious. And part of being status conscious in the 18th century, as a North American, wherever you live, is also being highly conscious about nationality and race. And so, in the end, the Ursulines were no more interested in remembering her Wabanaki history or her Wabanaki identity. They were, in fact, insistent from the very beginning, from the time that we see her name entered on the rolls of the convent in January of 1709. They call her Esther Anglaise or Esther Angloise, Esther English, essentially.
Yeah. Now was she rescued away from the Wabanaki, or how did she actually end up in Quebec?
Well, there are a couple of mission priests who circulate in Acadia. There are a couple of literal brothers who were also Jesuit fathers, Jacques and Vincent Bigot. And one of the brothers, Jacques Bigot, is recalled to Quebec to take an administrative position in the fall of 1708. It's only a conjecture of mine, but he and his brother had been bringing Wabanaki girls to enroll them in the Ursuline convent, where the Ursulines sort of took on the education and missionary role that the Jesuits maybe had begun. So for years he had been bringing these girls to the Ursulines, and so I believe that would have been her passage to Quebec. I don't have any direct evidence of this, but somehow she appears on the roll of the Ursuline convent school in January of 1709.
So does becoming a nun then, I mean, is that yet another form of a captivity for her, or does it actually afford her some freedom?
Well, and that's kind of the idea that I'm playing with in my book, right? The notion that there are captivities outside of just the official so-called captivity among the Wabanaki, which in the Anglo-American historical tradition, you know, we talk about Indian captivity, but we never talk about the captivities that especially girls and women would have lived in throughout their lives. I do believe that she did have opportunities for different kinds of experiences and different kinds of leadership within the convent, precisely because they're because of this new form of captivity, right? It looks from the outside like she's another captive. She's living within stone walls, within these huge gates, within the sort of very precise organization of the Ursuline convent. She's even living within layers and layers of fabric surrounding her head, surrounding her neck, surrounding her body with the distinctive Ursuline habit. But in many respects, this kind of captivity gives her opportunities for developing skills and leadership that she never would have been able to exert had she remained in Wabanakia or certainly in the Anglo-American community in Wells.
Right. So in the last minute or so that we have, I mean, that brings us to the idea that we started off with, that even though by one measure you might look at Esther Wheelwright's life and say she was just subject to the whim of fate again and again in her life, on the other hand, her portrait hangs at the Massachusetts Historical Society amongst all these other powerful men of early America. And you write that understanding her life helps us understand everything important in early North America. Why is that?
Well, I think that she shows the same kind of ambition and moxie that a lot of our so-called founding fathers did in U.S. historiography. We talk about the founding fathers, right? The men who fought the American Revolution and governed the early United States. She is the reason that that portrait hangs in the Massachusetts Historical Society. After she was elected Mother Superior, another nun, probably a young student or young novice, painted that portrait of her. And after it dried, she had it rolled up and sent to her family back in Boston. She wanted them to know exactly where she had ended up and what she had achieved. And I think that that's a very North American story.
Huh. Well, Anne Little is Associate Professor of History at Colorado State University. Her new book is The Many Captivities of Esther Wheelwright. She spoke to us today from Boulder, Colorado. Anne Little, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a really eye-opening story. Thanks again. Well, Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Emmajeen Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Caitlin O'Keefe and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back tomorrow for more Radio Boston.